Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Can't get one of Delaware's prized low-number black auto license plates? How about one of the new low-number surf fishing license plates instead?
Which tag do you want?
Two.
Yeah, how much are you willing to go for it?
I don't have a ceiling.
No?
No.
We take you to the wildly successful auction of these new plates last week. And a successful Rehoboth Beach songwriter has penned songs for Michael Bolton and Cher. Now he's writing for himself.
I didn't want to spend my entire life writing for other people. I want to really try to become an artist in the true sense of the word.
In our arts playlist, we introduce you to Doug James and his music. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also talk about the latest effort to spark development in downtown Dover. Look at how Delaware and other nearby states are doing in efforts to meet EPA water quality goals. And check out the newest product from Smyrna's Painted Stave Distillery. The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground, is next. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. In Delaware, auto license plates can confer status. The fewer digits you have on one, the bigger the bragging rights, and potentially the fatter your wallet could be should you choose to sell it. Now, as Delaware Public Media's James Dawson reports, surf fishing enthusiasts are getting their shot at showing off their state pride with limited edition plates that allow them to drive on the beach, stake their poles in the sand, and wait for a bite. And the response to auctioning off some of those plates last week was remarkable.
The scene looks like your typical auction, a small stage with room to see the swag up for bid and eccentric personalities readying their poker faces to juke their competition. But what's not typical is what bidders are vying for today, a chance to get their hands on the first numbered surf fishing tags the state's released since the late 1980s. They're similar to their black and white cousins that you can only get if your car is assigned a license plate number below 87,000. Private sales can fetch tens of thousands and upwards of hundreds of thousands of dollars for those, depending on how low the number is. According to LowDigitTags.com, a middleman for those buying and selling the plates. Former State Representative John Atkins sponsored a bill last year allowing the State Division of Parks and Recreation to press the surf fishing tags.
As a representative, when I was in office, that was one of the biggest constituent requests I had was, John, why don't they bring back, so, you know, I worked on it for the better part, you know, three cabinet secretaries in 10 years, and finally got it done, and hopefully, you know, it's going to raise some money.
And all the money raised will go to the state parks budget. Rich King, the owner of DelawareSurfFishing.com, came in early to check the competition. He has plenty of it, since he's going for the most coveted plate hitting the auction block.
Which tag do you want?
Two.
Yeah, how much are you willing to go for it?
I don't have a ceiling.
No?
No.
Why not?
It's money for the parks. It helps the parks. And I'm kind of, some ways, it's an investment. Plus, you know, nothing for nothing, but it says Delaware Surf Fishing on the tag. Kind of seems dumb not to get it.
Others have more modest aspirations. Dave Fronapple, a network engineer from Wilmington, made the two-hour trek south to see if he can drive away with one of the plates on the front of his vehicle for less than $650.
It very well possibly could go above my the range that I'm willing to pay, but if it stays somewhat reasonable, I certainly would love to see one on my truck.
The first plate on the block, number 100, started with a bid of $500 and broke Fronapple's budget in a matter of seconds. After about 10 minutes, the hammer fell with a final price of $12,200 with 15 plates left to go. All but one goes for more than $1,000. After sitting through several more high-dollar auctions, rolling his hat in between his hands, Fronapple decides to leave. He says the plates up for bid are too rich for his blood.
I could use a car instead of that, but it's such for a great cause. I'm really happy to see so many people bidding, and I think there was like 20 people bidding against that plate, so it shows the demand, and you know, Delaware really has a nice, rich culture that people are supporting.
55-year-old Stuart Snyder didn't bat an eye when he dropped $9,000 for the number 20 plate. He says it'll be a family heirloom, like the beach house his father left him after he died.
The tag is more of a postage stamp versus a beach house, but it's a neat legacy, and it'd be fun to give my kids and have them say, gee, thanks, Dad, when I'm long gone.
Onlookers warn Snyder to keep a close eye on it if he decides to mount it on the front of his car.
They said, you know, it's not going to be for long on my car, and I figured that I'd have to weld it so somebody might not think it'd be a nice addition to their den.
Eventually, the number two tag is up, with an unknown man ultimately paying $20,500. He quickly left, refusing interview requests from reporters. The live auction brought in nearly $114,000, according to State Parks Director Ray Bivens.
That essentially allows us to build a cabin, or that's the equivalent of about 23 lifeguards for us. So it's fabulous that people have been so generous. I think it says a lot about how much people love their Delaware State Parks and how much they love surf fishing.
Lots sold online so far have raked in a good bit of cash too, boosting the current total to about $181,000. Those who got outbid say they may try their luck at other online auctions, which will run through December. But those vying for a chance at the number one plate will have to wait until next year, with even fiercer bidding expected when it goes up for auction. James Dawson, Delaware Public Media.
A rare revenue enhancer that everyone seems to agree on. Thanks, James. 19-2. If I'm off on the math, you can discuss it. Stay with us. The Green continues in a moment with a conversation about a new effort to make Dover's downtown more welcoming. This is Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. A great deal of attention is being paid to developing Delaware's various downtowns, especially in the past year after Governor Jack Markell created his Downtown Development Districts program, which in its first year provided $5.6 million in grants for projects in the first three downtown districts in Wilmington, Dover, and Seaford. In Dover, that funding is building on ongoing downtown development work being done by groups such as the Downtown Dover Partnership and Dover-Kent County Metropolitan Planning Organization. One new project the Dover-Kent County MPO is launching is the Western Capital Gateway Plan, and it's seeking public input for the plan all next week during what it's calling Division Street Design Week, a series of public meetings November 16th, 17th, and 19th from 5 to 7 p.m. at the Inner City Sankofa Cultural Arts Center. This week, Dover-Kent County MPO Executive Director Rich Vetters joins us to discuss those meetings, the Gateway Plan, and the challenges of downtown development. Let's start with the Western Capital Gateway Plan. What exactly is that plan? What are you trying to accomplish with it?
Yeah, I guess it was initiated by the city. Obviously, there's a lot of interest in downtown Dover through Restoring Central Dover, which was an initiative that started in 2013. And through the Downtown Development District, there's a lot of interest, and from a public and a private perspective, to try to revitalize the downtown of Dover. This is also a state initiative as well. I mean, there's a lot of interest from the governor on down, from that perspective, from a policy perspective. So we're trying to build on some of those initiatives that have already been done. And this specific study, this specific planning study, is to look at Division Street and Forest Street, essentially to provide a western gateway. As you come in from the west, for instance, there's not really anything that defines that you're in Dover or that you're entering a downtown, for instance. So I think that's what we're trying to promote here and provide.
And that's an area that does have a lot of possibilities for development. Is it fair to say that with this plan, you're kind of hoping to get ahead of the development of the area so that the plan defines the development rather than the other way around?
That would be ideal, honestly. Yeah, I think we're trying to have, if a private developer were to come in, I mean, as you mentioned, there's some interest in this area. So if a private developer were to come in, we'd at least have a vision or a theme, to say, hey, we would like, the buildings closer to the road, for instance, or this type of landscaping, or just to be consistent with what the overall vision is.
And that's a lot of what this is to talk about streetscaping, landscaping, just kind of what the look and feel of this particular area you would like to be.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, essentially a blank slate at this point from our perspective and from the city's perspective in terms of what we actually want it to look like. So I think we want to hear from the public and hear from the property owners and the business owners that live there that, what do they want to see it look like? But obviously, I think the overall principal goal is to enhance the aesthetics. You're right.
And I guess, why is that important? Why is it important to have people have kind of that sense as they're coming down Division Street, for instance, that they know, okay, I'm in Dover and I'm heading into the downtown?
Yeah. Well, I think it's just a sense of place. I think we've heard that through some interviews that we've done with people that live there, in preparation for our public meetings, it would be ideal to provide that, or provide something that says we are in a different place. This is a place that I want to be, and it's a place I want to live, work, and play, kind of that type of theme.
And the public input part of this is in large part. So next week, the Division Street Design Week meetings that you're holding. I guess, what do you hope to get from that piece of the public engagement on this project?
Yeah, I guess it'll be November 16th, 17th, and 19th. It's what's called a charrette. So it's essentially a condensed public planning process, public meetings that are very hands-on. They're literally magic marker sessions for the public, you know, with maps. And I guess we just want to see this, you know, from the people that live there, what do they want to see? That's very basic, of course, but, you know, we need some ideas. You know, do they see, not even transportation related, but do they see a need for a playground or a ballpark or you know, just not really a ballpark, but just a place for kids to have a football catch, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and in terms of aesthetics, do they see a need for pedestrian scale lighting, you know, things like that. So these are just examples, of course. This is not set in stone, but we definitely want to hear what the public has to say.
Have you gotten some initial feedback from the public, maybe that's kind of like a baseline for what you expect to hear and be talking about next week?
Yeah, we've had, I'd say, at least 15 interviews with residents and with stakeholders and agency people throughout the region, throughout the city, I should say. I think one theme is people are interested in a gateway. I think they see the need for some type of feature, you know, or some type of special gateway treatment, I guess, if you will, where, you know, kind of splits off at Forest Street and Division Street. So I think that's one overlying theme. That, you know, we would like to hear from the public too. What do you want the gateway to look like? We've definitely heard about aesthetics, of course, in particular Forest Street. I mean, I think a lot of people see, you know, the streetscape that's on Lockerman Street now. They would like to see that extended to the west. So I think that's something definitely as well.
You mentioned at the beginning, I mean, this is all kind of part of these larger plans that are trying to kind of be interconnected, whether it be, you know, the downtown development districts, you know, restoring Central Dover Plan, things like that.
Sure.
You know, how important is that to kind of have all these things working in concert with each other to create what you would hope would be, you know, an end product that really works for downtown Dover?
I guess it helps in terms of the coordination, for instance. I mean, it's a lot of the same partners. I mean, NCAL, for instance, is very involved in our study now. I mean, they have a lot of outreach that they've done. You know, through their past efforts as well. So that's a huge help, huge asset for this particular study to gain outreach. Of course, DLDOT, from an agency perspective, has been very involved. You know, so I think that continuity definitely helps, and that kind of sets the guiding principles, I think, too. You know, from restoring Central Dover, it was kind of a more macro level, you know, 10,000-foot level. I think we're trying to hone in into specific corridors and get very specific. As a result of this study,
how critical do you think these projects are at this particular juncture? I mean, obviously, so many headlines people see about Dover right now involve crime.
Right.
Is one way to combat that issue to create this downtown that's more vibrant, that's more welcoming, that gives people, as you mentioned earlier, kind of that sense of place?
Yeah, it is. I think there's been numerous studies and you know, throughout the country of this happening, this being a success. You know, when you actually revitalize a downtown and make it somewhere where people want to go at night, you know, you have your businesses and you have activity. And, you know, I think it hopefully deters some of that element, no doubt. And I think that's the city, you know, from their leaders on down. I think that's one thing that they're very interested in this particular study, to have that effect.
And I imagine the other hurdle here is basic patience. I mean, coming out of an economic downturn, growth still slow. These are the type of plans that just don't happen overnight, right?
That's very correct. Yeah, it is.
So how important is that patience and kind of in making sure that people understand that even though they're part of the process, you want to bring them in next week to be part of the process, that it's going to take some time from that moment where they're sitting there with the markers you mentioned and actually seeing something happen and growing in that spot you're talking about?
Yeah, I think a good example of that would be in 2011, I believe it was, the Dover Transit Neighborhood Center plan that, you know, was completed. And then there's been some fruitful things that have actually come out of that. North Street is an example, the North Street streetscape, the transit center itself, obviously. There's some other, you know, pocket parks that have been developed, I think, at Governors and what street is that, Water?
Yep.
I believe North, you're correct. North Street, I'm sorry, okay. North and Governors. So those, you know, and even purchases of buildings have come out of that. So I think that study kind of set, you know, and that was, it just happened over a relatively short amount of time. I mean, 4-year period or so. And the state, you know, gave the city or provided the city with $3 million, you know, to do a lot of that work. So I think to answer your question, it basically takes a champion, though, too. You have to maintain that continuity. And I think the city is very behind that, and I think the MPO and as well. And, you know, we could hopefully provide that champion that it needs.
And those things that you're talking about, I mean, do you feel like they kind of give a sense of optimism that this is all headed in the right direction? That we have seen some of these initial things that have been accomplished. And obviously the downtown development districts, that's been an influx of money that's already, you know, leveraged some different things downtown already. Do you feel like there is that, at least some momentum building here?
There is. There definitely is. Yeah, I think there's a lot of interest, even in the next round of the downtown development district funding. I know they're trying to promote that on a residential scale this time as opposed to commercial. So they're hoping to get some of that smaller investors, I guess, you know, to improve properties and things like that. And that obviously will go a long way as well. You know, if you improve some of the dilapidated properties, you know, through public funding.
Anything else you want people to know heading into the Design Week meetings?
No, we're you know, very welcoming of participation, without a doubt. That this is, like I said, a grassroots effort. We don't have anything that's kind of preconceived at this point. You know, we know what the general guiding principles are, but I think we would really like for residents to come out and kind of support this effort.
Are you often surprised by some of the ideas people bring to meetings like this?
Oh, that's a good question. Sir, I think there's some ideas sometimes, sure, that you don't expect, but it's good. You know, if they live there, they know it better than I do as a government person. So I think we welcome that input.
Thanks to Dover Kent County MPO Executive Director Rich Vetters for his time this week. Again, the Division Street Design Week public meetings are November 16th, 17th, and 19th from 5 to 7 p.m. each night at the Inner City Sankofa Cultural Arts Center. And there's more to come on The Green, including a look at how Delaware and others in the region are doing in efforts to meet EPA goals for improving water quality. You're listening to Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. By 2025, Chesapeake Bay watershed states aim to drastically reduce the amount of pollutants and sediment they put into bay waterways. Using everything from new stormwater equipment to tree plantings, they're working toward ambitious goals set by the Environmental Protection Agency 6 years ago. But states like Delaware aren't on track to meet 2017 halfway point milestones. A lack of state funding is limiting its options, and failing to meet EPA goals could only make it worse. As part of Delaware Public Media's collaboration with WYPR in Baltimore and Virginia Public Radio, our Annie Ropeek looks at efforts to keep those 2025 goals in sight.
Tucked away in southwestern Delaware is a farmland oasis. It's October, and Bill Jester's cornfields are barren, but between them, things are growing.
This is like a kidney-shaped wetlands.
And so what did this look like before?
Farmland. It was actually tilled.
He's created this 3-acre inland marsh with the help of Delaware's Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program, or CREP. It pays farmers to make eco-friendly upgrades that prevent runoff where they can't or don't want to grow crops.
They picked out the plants and the bushes, and, you know, there was different kind of flowering bushes and all for the different kind of animals and all involved. And as you can see from here up, is a completely different project.
The annual payouts themselves aren't much, $104 for an acre of grass, $135 for an acre of wetland. That came out of a much larger state fund set up in 1990, but this year it's run out. Bob Palmer heads up conservation programs for Delaware's Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Control, or DENREC.
Knowing this was coming, we as a department have recommended a CREP line item, a budget item, for the last 5 years, and it just hasn't gained any traction.
Delaware is facing a $130 million budget deficit, and little programs like the CREP are being shelved, meaning the state won't get the matching federal funds that go with them. That won't impact Bill Jester this year. He's not up for re-enrollment, and the USDA will still cover its 20% of the CREP's cost until he is. But losing the CREP poses a much larger problem, says DENREC's Marcia Fox. She's the lead on the state's Chesapeake Bay Watershed Implementation Plan. It's Delaware's piece of EPA goals for cleaning up Bay Region waterways.
We decided by 2025 that we would have 7,020 acres of riparian forest buffer on the ground. And in Delaware, most of those acres are implemented through the CREP program. In the past few years, we haven't been too successful with implementation just because of the funding being cut and the willingness of some of the farmers.
By last year, they'd only planted about 2,500 acres of trees on watershed soil, and that was with the CREP up and running. Now that it's suspended, Fox says they'll have to rely on less effective EPA-approved best management practices.
So we have to be extremely innovative in the upcoming years as we approach our 2017 midpoint.
Delaware is far behind states like Maryland and Virginia in the race to meet the EPA's ambitious goals for reducing runoff. They've tried to innovate on a big scale. Just last month, Maryland introduced a nutrient credit trading program inspired by Virginia's. It lets private and public entities team up to contribute different load reductions to the total. Ben Grumbles is Maryland's Secretary of the Environment.
It's a very important way to do more than just the status quo or the command and control tools of the last 20 years. And that is what the writers of the Chesapeake Bay pollution budget were envisioning, was that there'd be innovation to bring more parties into the mix.
He says it would be convenient to team up with Delaware on the Delmarva Peninsula, but DENREC officials say Delaware is too small to make large-scale credit trading practical, and the agricultural sector doesn't seem interested. So how will the first state meet its 2017 goals? Marcia Fox, the watershed plan lead, says they'll reevaluate that in the coming months to see,
you know, who do we need to work with? How do we need to become more innovative with the best management practices and the funding?
That could mean getting the EPA to add new things Delaware's already doing to its list of what counts toward runoff goals, or it could mean working with nonprofits and other federal agencies on their old favorite, tree planting. Still, Delaware and other lagging states will likely face EPA penalties in 2017 for not meeting midway goals. Fox wouldn't speculate on how much federal funding Delaware stands to lose or earn back if new practices get approved down the line. But if the state can't pay for its own incentives, she says it'll be hard to convince land users, people like Bill Jester, to stay involved in restoration work. Jester, though, says it's not just about the money. He says he could make three times as much farming on his CREP land as he does from incentives, but he and farmers like him don't mind doing their share. Plus, he says,
how do you measure the return of something you like to do?
We're riding on a little tractor to see another part of Jester's farm, one that was improving the watershed long before Jester was getting public money in return.
Now, this begins the 45 acres of pine trees. These are specifically planted.
We've crossed one of his cornfields into a huge pine forest, planted as rows of saplings in 1986. It's a crop like anything else, but this is a long-term project.
We did it once in 25 years, then we'll probably wait till 35, another 10, and everything you see from here out will be cut.
Across the Jester property, there's a pond Bill's father dug, stocked with fish and lined by trees in brilliant fall color. Again, not state-funded, he says, but just something nice for the land. Still, he thinks the state could get more farmers involved in its programs.
I don't know if the owners, you know, you got to take the initiative to go there. I don't know if it'd be better if they went around and tried to sell it more. But listen, you hear an airplane, but
even without incentives, he says, all these ponds, wetlands, and forests help his land stay healthy, and he'll aim to keep it that way well into the future. For Delaware Public Media, I'm Annie Ropeek in Harrington.
Thanks, Annie. And a reminder, this piece was produced as part of Delaware Public Media's collaboration with WYPR in Baltimore and Virginia Public Radio to examine issues affecting the Delmarva Peninsula and Chesapeake watershed. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Rehoboth Beach singer-songwriter Doug James has penned hit songs for artists like Cher and Michael Bolton. Now he's writing for himself. James will soon release his first CD, and next week honors his late musical mentor with a show at the Music School of Delaware in Wilmington. The concert is dedicated to Larry Walker, James's high school music teacher and one-time faculty member at the music school's Milford branch. James will also explore the craft of songwriting with budding artists at a workshop at the music school this weekend. In our arts playlist, Delaware Public Media's Kathy Carter talks to Doug James about his career. We'll also hear a track from the new CD and a song recorded in our studio this week.
Doug, a few years after you graduated from college, you headed to New York City to make your name as a songwriter, most famously with Michael Bolton, How Am I Supposed to Live Without You? Also wrote tracks for Cher and Chaka Khan. What were some of your earlier successes as a songwriter?
Oh, gosh. I was very fortunate. The first one that really made some noise was with Dionne Warwick. She recorded a song called After You. And the song was a hit. That was a thrill. And Don't Tell Me, Tell Her was a hit for Odyssey. And Angela Beaufil recorded a song called Break It To Me Gently.
Now, back during this era, when radio was king, what was it like hearing your song on the radio for the first time, a song that you had written?
It was something special. I lived in New York City for about 10 years. I would jog all over the city, and I remember running down 42nd Street one weekend afternoon, and I just stopped because all the music stores were there, and they have speakers, and WBLS was playing. And all of a sudden, I just stopped in my tracks because After You was on the radio. And it was followed immediately by Don't Tell Me, Tell Her with Odyssey. So I thought I'd died and gone to heaven.
Also, as a songwriter, you're a member of what must be a very exclusive club, which is you wrote a song that was a hit twice, once for Laura Branigan and once for Michael Bolton. Of course, we're talking about How Am I Supposed to Live Without You?
Yes, that was the first song I wrote when I went to CBS Songs. They introduced Michael and I and said, get in there and write us a hit, what they said. It was in a fluorescent office and with an old Yamaha piano in there. And Michael and I just sat and told jokes for about 45 minutes just to break the ice. And got up and sat down at the piano and just started messing around. And Michael came up behind me and he, you know, I didn't know him from a hole in the wall, basically. And I don't know if you've ever seen that Victor Borger routine where the opera singer starts to sing and it knocks him off the piano bench. Well, that's about what happened that day. He's right behind me, and he has opened up, and it scared me. But we had a great time. I think it took us about three sessions. We had most of it written in the first day, but it took us about three sessions to get it.
In his book, The Soul of It All, My Music, My Life, he said at some point, nearly every song becomes work. So this song was work, three sessions it took for you to really nail it.
Absolutely. Michael and I would work deep into the night. We wrote about 25 songs together. We most of the time, we had to bribe the watchman to let us stay after hours. And we would be up there until 4 or 5 in the morning, every morning. Just worked very hard on that and all the songs we worked on. And I remember when they came and told us that Laura Branigan was going to record it. It was just an incredible day. And then later, Michael did the song. So thank goodness.
As a songwriter yourself, I hear many stories from songwriters that say songwriting is a craft, and then there are others that say some songs just come to them as almost visions. Have you had an experience with both, that just one morning you wake up and there's a melody in your head?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. But I think it's, at least for me, it's the old adage, 5% inspiration and 95% perspiration. It's writing and rewriting and rewriting. And every once in a while, somebody says, oh, yeah, I wrote that while I was in line at the grocery store. I say, well, good for you. That hasn't happened for me too often.
Right. Well, one of the reasons we're talking at this juncture is that you'll be giving a concert. It's in memory of your mentor. Tell us about Larry Lee Walker.
This past May, I got some very bad news. A dear friend of mine had passed away. He was my music teacher at St. Andrews. And my mentor and my friend in all the years since, at his memorial service at St. Andrews, I happened to meet the dean of the Music School of Delaware. And Mr. Walker, after working 30 years at St. Andrews, went on to work about 9 years, I think, at the Music School of Delaware. And I met Sherry Astalsi. She's the dean of the school there. And I approached her later and said, what about the idea of doing I'd like to do a concert dedicated to Mr. Walker. So they liked the idea, much to my delight, and that's what we're going to do on November 14th.
Well, fantastic. Let's give our listeners maybe a sneak preview. You were good enough to bring your keyboard to our studio here at Delaware Public Media. What can you play for us right now, Doug?
Well, I'm going to try a song called September Rain. And another lifelong friend by the name of Keith Mack is going to be playing that night. He co-produced the album with me. And he was going to be here today, but he's under the weather. But Keith will be with me that night. But you get an idea of the song.
As I walk home through the warm September rain, I remember love was not so long ago. You and I, my summer friend, thought summertime would never end, and our sandy castles forever would remain. But we said goodbye in the warm September rain. Drifting with you through a summer long vacation. A couple of fools living on a song and a dime. Just when you think that life is perfect, suddenly it changes. go to sleep as perfect lovers, wake up as perfect strangers. But time goes on and we forget the pain. When summer's gone, comes the warm September rain. Wrapped in your arms, on a windswept beachfront, I could sail through the stars with you by my side. So how could it all just fall apart? I'm searching for the reasons. Was it just a change of heart or just a change of season? That once upon a time we can never regain. When summer's gone, comes the warm September rain. Oh, I can hear the seabirds calling, feel the summer breeze coming through. The September rain keeps falling, falling, falling. Warm as my memories, all my memories of you. How could it all just fall apart? Searching for the reasons. Was it just a change of heart or just a change of seasons? But I'll remember all the love, forget the pain. When summer's gone, comes the warm September rain. Yeah, when summer's gone, comes the warm September rain.
That was Doug James with September Rain, recorded here at Delaware Public Media. We'll have more of our conversation with James coming up. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. As a songwriter, Doug James has penned songs for many top recording artists. He co-wrote Michael Bolton's biggest hit, How Am I Supposed to Live Without You? Now the Delaware-based musician is taking center stage with a new CD of his own. Next week, he'll perform at the Music School of Delaware's Concert Hall in Wilmington. Our arts playlist continues with more of our conversation with Doug James.
Doug, before the break and before you played us your song September Rain, you mentioned an album. So let's talk about that album, which is going to be called All Roads. This is your first CD after writing for so many other people.
Yeah. It's called All Roads because I feel like I've been up and down about every single one of them getting this thing done. So I didn't want to spend my entire life writing for other people. When you're a staff writer, you become a chameleon. You've got to produce so many songs a year. So when I got to the point I could walk away from being a staff writer, I took the opportunity and said, I want to really try to become an artist in the true sense of a word and really try to turn myself into an artist hopefully capable of doing the songs justice. So that's a long-winded answer to your question.
Well, you mentioned your life taking so many different twists and turns. One of them was you discovered you were adopted. You never knew that growing up. You were never told.
No. Mom died in 85, and 4 years later, almost to the day, my dad died. And in September of 89, I happened to be going through his closet, and they're right at eye level, and I've been through his closet 50 times, you know, not happily, but you know, you have to do those things when all this mess happens. But there was this book. I took it down. It said Our Heritage, Our Family Heritage. And I opened up to my dad's page, and it said Will James married Betty Ann Adams, one adopted child, Douglas Thomas James. And I literally dropped to my knees. And when I did, out of the front of the book fell this loose page. And I picked it up, and it said, page 101, Will James married Betty Ann Adams, one child, Douglas Thomas James. The word adopted had been struck. So that began a long Sherlock Holmes-ish adventure of trying to find out exactly what in the devil had happened. And I found out that I had been adopted, and my folks tried to have kids, and they couldn't. A friend of my mom's that had a child out of wedlock had asked mom and dad to raise her child, and they did for a couple of years. And then all of a sudden, she came back, the mother came back and wanted her child back. And it just about killed my mom, and darn near killed my dad. So later on, when they adopted me, mom said, the agency wanted the money, we wanted the baby, and I don't want anything ever more said about this again. A friend of mine who could have lost his job over this, but he actually peeked into the adoption files. Thank God he did, because he said, your family was from the Honga River area on Hooper's Island. And so with that lead, I was able to finally track down my natural mom. She was living in Elkton, and then I found I have four half-sisters who I've met and just absolutely think the world of.
And you found out something uniquely Delawarean about your heritage, too.
Right, right. Hooper's Island was a Nanticoke Indian Reserve, and I found out that I'm part Nanticoke. Exactly how much, I don't know, but that was one of the things. It was a curveball I wasn't expecting.
Well, life's curveballs can make for some great songs, and we'd love to play another one. Now, you brought along a new song called Life is Mostly Beautiful with You. It's going to be on your new CD called All Roads, and we'll leave with that track, Life is Mostly Beautiful with You.
Appreciate it.
You can. Your life is mostly beautiful with you. I don't lie, I will die trying to teach you to drive. But life is mostly beautiful with you. Although we never agree on what movie to see, you're Bambi and I'm Godfather too. When the movie show ends, that our evening begins, and life is mostly beautiful with you. Yeah, life is mostly beautiful with you. You and all the many beautiful things you do. There's no clouds of dark, you don't come shining. Beautiful, you're mostly beautiful with you.
beautiful. Yeah, all mostly beautiful.
That's Doug James and Life is Mostly Beautiful with You from his forthcoming CD, All Roads. You can see James in concert Saturday, November 14th at the Music School of Delaware's Concert Hall in Wilmington. And The Green continues in a moment with Enlighten Me and a trip to the Painted Stave Craft Distillery in Smyrna. This is Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green. I'm Tom Byrne. When most people hear the word bourbon, they think of the rolling green fields of Kentucky, the state most closely associated with the sweet, mostly corn-based whiskey. But soon those in Delaware won't have to trek far to get their hands on locally produced bourbon. In this week's Enlighten Me, Delaware Public Media's James Dawson tells us one distillery has just uncorked a few barrels of the iconic liquor right in the heart of the first state.
The sounds you're hearing have been reverberating within the old Smyrna Theater for the past few years, since Ron Gomes and Mike Rasmussen opened Painted Stave Distilling, the state's first standalone craft distillery, in November 2013. But the latest liquid getting a new glass home is a deep caramel amber color that likely hasn't ever been distilled legally in Delaware's history. Gomes and Rasmussen laid down about 30 gallons of Diamond State bourbon whiskey last year. The end product coming out now is very even keeled for a young bourbon. Rasmussen, a bourbon aficionado, has wanted to distill the spirit since he and Gomes first made plans to open the business in 2011. He says opening up something you haven't seen in a year is one of his favorite parts of the process.
It's like a little time capsule. I mean, getting to tap open the first three kegs of this and sample them and, you know, really think about the different flavor components and how those different barrels had matured over the course of a year. So you get to really see how something has changed, and I think it's a lot of fun.
The whiskey packs a punch, but it's not overwhelming. Notes of cinnamon, oak, and winter spices temper the slight bite, making it pleasantly warm when served neat. Part of the spiciness is due to the high amount of rye grain they use, making up 26% of the blend. 65% of their bourbon is made from local corn, with the rest of it malted barley.
We want some of the spicy flavors to come through from the rye. Corn adds a nice sweetness. And then knowing what we knew about the barrels and how we were integrating, what we hoped to see were some of the vanilla and toffee characteristics come out, as well as some of the baker's spices, cinnamon and nutmeg and those types of flavors that really can be extracted from the wood.
To legally be considered bourbon in the United States, you have to use at least 51% corn in the distilling process, meet certain proofing benchmarks, and store it in new charred American oak barrels. You've also got to reveal the whiskey's age on the bottle if it's less than 4 years old. Eventually, Painted Stave will release older vintages, but that means more time in the barrel. With that, the formerly clear alcohol takes on characteristics from the barrels they're aged in, as well as the surrounding environment. Gomes is also trying out honeycombed barrels that increase the surface area coming into contact with the bourbon and shaping the flavor in a new way.
So really increased opportunities to drive molecular interactions that you're interested in to produce the flavor compounds that you want, the smoothing effects, the barrel notes that you want.
He says that can drop the amount of time a spirit needs to age to achieve the desired characteristics. Craft distilling in Delaware is still relatively new. Legislation allowing the businesses to open wasn't passed until 2013 after Painted Stave and others lobbied the General Assembly. In this fresh market, Rasmussen says they've been able to reshape people's views on how spirits should taste beyond other mass-produced incarnations.
We see people who walk through who, oh, I don't like this spirit because I've only ever tried it once and it was not good, and so I don't drink gin at all. And they're leaving with bottles of gin. And they're standing at the bar telling people, oh my God, I can't believe how much I love this.
And bourbon does get an especially clean start in the first state, something that appealed to Gomes.
It's a blank slate for us. There's no regional, local story to tie to this other than, you know, it hasn't been done before, legally. We get to invent that story. We get to as much as we've invented the product, we get to invent the brand and invent the story behind the brand. And that's pretty cool, pretty special.
Education plays a large role at Painted Stave. Both men do hold doctorate degrees. Gomes was a professor of orthopedics at Penn State College of Medicine, while Rasmussen worked for the Rodell Foundation and the Vision Network in Delaware in his past life. It's something that's immediately apparent, especially in how the company runs their bottling line. They put out notices on social media calling for volunteers who help fill, label, number, and package the latest spirit slated for release or a batch of one of their core products. Some even helped pick and sort hundreds of pounds of cranberries recently for Painted Stave's seasonal cranberry vodka. The company turns 2 years old this month, and in that brief span, Rasmussen says he's seen their approach take hold, giving people a deeper connection with what they drink. He says he expects that to carry over into the bourbon.
We want people to leave with a better understanding of what the product is. We obviously want them to be excited and enjoy consuming the product. And then, as with anything here in Delaware, we love Delaware products and we love Delaware things. And so my guess is we're going to get a lot of people who are very excited about this simply because it's the first time it's been done here in Delaware.
You can only pick up one of the 160 bottles at their distillery in Smyrna when it goes on sale for $40 a bottle Saturday, November 14th at noon. That night, the company will also hold its two-year anniversary party, which is free and open to the public. James Dawson, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, James, for enlightening us this week. And that's all for The Green this week. A reminder, the stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website and on iTunes. We're also looking for your feedback or story ideas. So take some time and connect with us on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, Delaware Public Media's Kathy Carter, James Dawson, and Annie Ropeek, as well as our president and station manager, Casey Houts. For all of them, I'm Tom Byrne. Thanks so much for joining us this week, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.